Face becomes that of every man. Close to death, a face we all know, if only from the funeral art of Christian churches. By the time she died, my mother was no longer recognisable. I last saw her on the morning of the day she died, before I set off to work. I had spent the night in my parents' house, sleeping on the floor of my father's study, near my parents' bedroom. I could hear her rasping breath through the open doors between the study where I was lying and her bedroom. When I went to see her at 4 in the morning, she shook her head when I asked her if she wanted some water and morphine, even though one would have thought from her appearance that she was already dead, had it not been for her laboured, occasional breathing. Before I finally left, I said to her, to her death mask, as I held her hand, "You're still here." Almost imperceptibly, she slowly nodded her head. I cannot remember my last sight of her when I went to work in the morning. It no longer mattered. I had said goodbye to her many times already. My sister rang me shortly after midday, as I sat at some dull medical meeting, to say she had died a few minutes earlier. Her breathing, she told me, had become shallower and shallower, until eventually my family, who were gathered round her bed, realized, with slight surprise, that she had died. I felt no need to pay her body my final respects. As far as I was concerned, her body had become a meaningless shell. I say body, I could just as well talk of her brain. As I had sat by her bedside, I had often thought of that, of how the millions upon millions of nerve cells and their near infinite connections that formed her brain, her very self, were struggling and fading. I remember her on that last morning, just before I went to work, her face sunken and wasted, unable to move, unable to talk, unable to open her eyes, yet when I asked her if she wanted any water to drink, she shook her head. Within this dying, ruined body invaded by cancer cells, she was still there, even though she was now refusing even water and clearly anxious not to prolong her dying any longer. And now all those brain cells are dead, and my mother, who in a sense was the complex electrochemical interaction of all these millions of neurons, is no more. In neuroscience, it is called the binding problem. The extraordinary fact, which nobody can even begin to explain, that mere brute matter can give rise to consciousness and sensation. I had such a strong sensation as she lay dying that some deeper, real person was still there behind the death mask. What makes for a good death? Absence of pain, of course, but there are many aspects to dying and pain is only one part of it. Like most doctors, I suppose I have seen death in all its many forms, and my mother was indeed lucky to die in the way that she did. If I ever think about my own death, which, like most people, I try to avoid, I hope for a quick end with a heart attack or stroke, preferably while asleep. But I realize that I may not be so fortunate. I may very well have to go through a time when I am still alive, but have no future to hope for, and only a past to look back on. My mother was lucky to believe in some kind of life beyond death, but I do not have this faith. The only consolation I will have, if I do not achieve instant extinction, will be my own last judgment on my life as I look back on it. I must hope that I live my life now in such a way that, like my mother, I will be able to die without regret. As my mother lay on her deathbed, drifting in and out of consciousness, sometimes lapsing into her German mother tongue, she said, "It's been a wonderful life. We have said everything there is to say." Chapter 19. Akinetic Mutism. Noun. A syndrome characterized by the inability to speak, loss of voluntary movement, and apparent loss of emotional feeling. Neuroscience tells us that it is highly improbable that we have souls, as everything we think and feel is no more or no less than the electrochemical chatter of our nerve cells. Our sense of self, our feelings and our thoughts, our love for others, our hopes and ambitions, our hates and fears, all die when our brains die. Many people deeply resent this view of things, which not only deprives us of life after death, but also downgrades thought to mere electrochemistry and reduces us to mere automata, to machines. Such people are profoundly mistaken, since what it really does is upgrade matter into something infinitely mysterious that we do not understand. There are 100 billion nerve cells in our brains. Does each one have a fragment of consciousness within it? How many nerve cells do we require to be conscious or to feel pain? Or does consciousness and thought reside in the electrochemical impulses that join these billions of cells together? Is a snail aware? Does it feel pain when you crush it underfoot? Nobody knows. An eminent and eccentric neurologist, who had sent me many patients over the years, asked me to examine a woman I had operated on a year earlier who was in a persistent vegetative state. I had operated for a ruptured arteriovenous malformation after she had suffered a life-threatening hemorrhage, and I had operated as an emergency. It had been a difficult operation, and although it had saved her life, it could not undo the damage done to her brain by the hemorrhage. She had been in a coma before the operation and remained in a coma for many weeks afterwards. She had been transferred back to her local hospital some weeks after the operation, where she had been under the care of the neurologist who now wanted me to see her in the long-term nursing home in which she had ended up. Before she was transferred to the nursing home, I had carried out a shunt operation for the hydrocephalus, which had developed as a late after-effect of the original bleed. Although the shunt operation had been a relatively minor one, one I would usually delegate to my juniors, I remembered it well because I had carried it out at the local hospital and not in my own neurosurgical centre. I scarcely ever operate away from my own theatres, except when I'm working abroad. I had gone to the local district hospital, where she was a patient, with a tray of instruments and one of my registrars. I had gone vainly thinking that the visit of a senior neurosurgeon to the hospital, since brain surgery was not normally performed there, would be an event of some importance and be of some interest. But apart from the desperate family, everybody else in the hospital seemed scarcely to notice my arrival. The local neurologist, who was away at the time of my visit, had told the family that the operation might relieve her persistent vegetative state. I was less optimistic and said so, but there was little to be lost by trying, and so, after discussing this with them, I went down to the operating theatres where, I was told, the staff were ready for me to operate. The nurses and the anaesthetists greeted me with total indifference, which I found quite disconcerting. I had to wait 2 hours before the patient was brought down for the operation, and when she eventually came into the theatre, the staff all worked in sluggish and sullen silence. The contrast to my own friendly and energetic neurosurgical theatres was remarkable. I had no way of knowing whether they felt that I was wasting their time by operating on a human vegetable, or whether this was just their normal way of behaving. So I operated, reported back to the family afterwards, and drove back to London. As the months passed after this second operation, it became clear that the shunt had made no difference to her condition, and her neurologist wanted me to examine the patient and see if the shunt was working or if it had blocked. It seemed a little cruel and unnecessary to drag her all the way to my hospital in an ambulance, just for my opinion, so I had agreed, a little reluctantly, as I knew that I could not help, to visit her in the nursing home that now cared for her.